word of the Lord. Now, I should probably preface what I'm going to say this evening by saying I think a lot of the interesting, helpful things I hope I say. I actually heard a really good sermon series on Habakkuk myself 3 or 4 years ago that I remembered quite a bit of and pulled that out when Dominic asked me to speak tonight. So Tim Keller, one of my favorite preachers, heard him preach on this series. And if you hear anything that you enjoy or is helpful, it was probably him, not me. I should give credit where credit's due. But about Habakkuk himself, you know, we know very little. We just don't know that much about the prophet Habakkuk. We don't even know how to pronounce his name for sure. You've heard me saying Habakkuk here, and you might be saying, no, it's actually Habakkuk, or whatever. It's a little bit tricky. It's an Akkadian loanword, and we're not precisely sure how it's pronounced. I say Habakkuk. You might say Habakkuk. My mother-in-law says Habakkuk. That's fine. I'll say Habakkuk tonight. There you go. It's a fascinating little book, isn't it, as you read through it and look at it. It's toward the end of the Old Testament, and it's called a minor prophet. Habakkuk is called a minor prophet. Not that he's unimportant or that he's under 18 if you're in the United States. Instead, the book of Habakkuk is called a minor prophet. It's shorter than the other prophets that you find it around, shorter than Isaiah or Jeremiah, some of these other prophets in the Old Testament, toward the end of the Old Testament. The shorter prophets are referred to as the minor prophets, and Habakkuk is one of them. In terms of history, we don't know that much about Habakkuk. He might have been writing about the same time as Jeremiah or Zephaniah. We think that that's possible, perhaps around the time of Daniel or Ezekiel. No other prophet mentions his name, so it's kind of hard to figure out where he is relative to other prophets from that. The book of Habakkuk does mention his name twice. In the first chapter here, you saw in verse 3, and then at the beginning of chapter 3, it mentions his name. He certainly is a primary character of the book and these dialogues with God that he has, but we just don't know much about him other than what can be inferred from this book. And a prof in seminary who said Habakkuk was the prophet with a question mark above his head. And I like that. I mean, I think that kind of describes what you see in the book. He's got a lot of questions, and he's asking God and wrestling with God and questioning God all these different ways. And I think it pretty well fits what you see in the rest of the book. In terms of the date of the book, and I mean that kind of also gives way, it's a bit tricky to know precisely when this happened. Habakkuk doesn't mention any of the kings by name, so you can't use the historical books like Kings or Chronicles to sort of say, right, here's where this happened. However, he does prophesy about the impending doom of Judah there in verse 6 in this first chapter. And we're a bit uncertain how far into the future that exact event is from when he actually gives the prophecy. Most likely, it seems like it was probably sometime after the good, godly king Josiah, who brought about significant moral reforms that you read about. He was one of the good kings in Judah, and it perhaps was after him in the reign of Jehoiakim. That's many people think it was during Jehoiakim's reign, which was about 608 to 598. So short reign, 10-year reign, 608 to 598 BC. That would be before Nebuchadnezzar started his military campaigns, before this Babylonian campaign started at all. They started in kind of Egypt and in Palestine in 605, probably, or somewhere around there, so it would have been before that. And he probably was prophesying around then, before that had happened. So he probably witnessed Babylon coming in and destroying Nineveh, the Assyrian capital, in 612, somewhere around there. He probably saw the ultimate defeat of the Assyrians somewhere around 605 in the Battle of Carchemish. He probably also saw all these prophecies, it seems like, the way it's written, fulfilled, where the Babylonians came in to Judah in 605, again in 597, and then finally in 586. Don't worry about all those dates. You don't have to write it. I'm just kind of trying to put this in perspective. That's probably about the time. Twilight of Judah, Babylonian captivity kind of looming. That's when he's writing. I mean, it's somewhere around there. That's just a little background. Like I said, about Habakkuk, we aren't precisely sure. We just know before Judah falls is when he says these things. So a bit of background for that. Let's focus our attention on this first chapter for the rest of the evening. And what we'll do is we'll look at this first chapter just under four headings. You have them on the sheet. We're just going to think about what Habakkuk saw, what Habakkuk did, what Habakkuk heard, and then what it all meant. What Habakkuk saw, what he did, what he heard, and what it meant. So first, let's think a little bit about what we see here that Habakkuk saw. In verse 3, you see it, Habakkuk says, "Why do you make me look at injustice?" And that word he uses there, injustice, it's a pretty general word in Hebrew. It means sorrow or grief or trouble. What is he saying? He's saying, why have you put me in the position where I see all this evil around me? Why have you put me in this position where I'm seeing all these things happen? Why does he ask that question? What does he mean when he asks that? Well, if you think about it, King Josiah, who probably preceded the time he's speaking of here, he was a good ruler, and he likely preceded Habakkuk's ministry. And King Josiah gave the people, it would seem, a bit of hope, the way he's talked about, okay, you know, things are getting better. Josiah was a reformer, taking the people back to the Lord. And people probably thought, right, good times might be coming. You know, things might be getting better. And then all of a sudden, after Josiah, his sons are just terrible. They're far worse than he is. Downward spiral begins again with the nation. And things are clearly not getting better at that point. They're getting worse. And that's why Habakkuk says in verse 4, the law is paralyzed, justice never prevails, the wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. In other words, he's saying we're living in evil days, right? We're living in evil times. I can see it all around me. I can see the things that are happening. It's not just that the days are evil either that he's upset about. It's God doesn't seem to be intervening. God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. And that's Habakkuk's complaint in verses 2 through 4. It kind of amounts to, well, why aren't you doing anything? How can you stand all this abhorrent behavior? Have you abandoned us? Have you forgotten about us? Now, the reason for this is very significant for us to see. And I think it's this. Everybody has sort of good seasons and bad seasons. Everybody has good days and evil days, periods of time. We might think this year is better than the last, or maybe it's a bit worse, but the next one to come will hopefully be better. And the tendency probably for most people is to think, well, things will be better in the future once this thing gets fixed, or once we get this behind us, or once we make it through this season, or our kids will have a better future than we did, or maybe our investments will go up. At least that's what your investment advisor will certainly want you to think, right? We look ahead and we think, right, okay, well, in the future, maybe it'll be a little bit better. In general, people are encouraged to think that way in many ways. But I want you to think back maybe just historically about how societies tend to think of these things. Think back to the early 20th century, right? Early 20th century, from like 1870 to 1910, Europe, America, people were basically optimistic in that period. A lot of progress, lots of development, industrial and otherwise. A large peacetime, by and large, during a lot of those times. But then what happened in the first part of the 20th century? World War One, right? World War One happened, and then the Great Depression, this worldwide phenomenon where the whole world really had some pretty desperate hard times, and then the Holocaust and World War Two, and all of a sudden by the end of the 40s, you had people even in Europe starving in the winter, and many terrible things happening, and people were saying, wow, what was good days now? These are evil days, and when will it get better? Year after year of disappointment and things not getting better. Failure after failure, trial after trial for many people in that time, and people were understandably worried, right? And they looked at, oh, I think this is bad times. Will it ever get better? And it had been completely the opposite before that. And you think about, well, where are we today? You know, where are we today in that? And not that I'm a harbinger of doom or gloom or anything, but you do think, wow, yeah, in the last few years there have been some difficult things, haven't there? In the last 4 or 5 years, there have been institutions that have failed. We might have thought, wow, that never thought that could happen. Global financial crisis, Eurozone crisis, Greek financial contagion, Spain worries, all these things that you hear in the news, troubles. Huge amounts of wealth have been lost in the last 4 or 5 years, no doubt. And it'd be foolish probably for people just to assume, well, you know, things are going to go just right back to the way they were tomorrow or in a year. They might not. We don't know. We don't know what normal is, perhaps, even a situation like that. And people in history have constantly thought, well, you know, things will get better soon. But the fact is we just don't quite know on some of these things, and history bears that out. You don't quite know what the patterns of history are. We might be in a season of evil days, you know, as Habakkuk is complaining about. And we need to ask, are we ready for that? Are we trusting God through that, as we'll see in this book? And that's what Habakkuk sees around him. He sees evil days. He sees this difficult time around him. And not only that, God doesn't seem to be there. He doesn't think he sees God there. He thinks God has abandoned them. That's the first thing, what Habakkuk saw. But second, look what he does. Look at how Habakkuk responds to that. We'll jump here just to the end of the passage, just to sort of see how I respond before we come back and say the one answer God has in this first chapter. In order to understand, I think, what he does, you need to see just kind of two things working in Habakkuk's life, two things working in the way he responds. Habakkuk was really, really frank here. It might be hard to tell what are the words of Habakkuk and what are the words of God. Habakkuk says in 2 through 4, that's his complaint, and then God's response is in verses 5 through 11. Habakkuk again is speaking there in 12 through 17. And so you see he's really frank in those sections at the beginning of the chapter, 2 through 4, and at the end of the chapter, 12 through 17. He's really frank in what he says to God. I mean, almost to the point of offensive. He's really pushing with what he says to God. And he says, why do you tolerate wrongdoing, in verse 3? That's pretty direct. But in verse 12, his language, it's even more astonishing. And the force of what he says, it really doesn't come across, I don't think, in the English translation as strongly as it could. He says, Lord, are you not from everlasting? Are you not eternal? And in English, that doesn't sound too hostile. But in Hebrew, it's actually quite a bit stronger. It's rhetorical. He's asking a rhetorical question, as you can see there. And rhetorical statements are rarely requests for information, right? They're not usually requests for information. And instead, usually a rhetorical statement is employed to sort of subvert some sort of a point. And he's saying something more like this. I thought you were infinite. I thought you're the almighty, wise, good, eternal God. But with what's happening, I'm not so sure. He almost says something like that. He comes close to saying something like that, at least. And Hebrew scholars even here will tell you that this word that it starts with, are you not, it's most commonly used in sort of vigorous human arguments that people have. It's not used in address to God. You don't see it elsewhere in the scriptures where people address God like that, sort of accusatory tone. It's sort of shocking, actually, to see Habakkuk say, you're allowing violence, and come to God in this, not in a lowly mood, but almost in a confrontational, anguishing mood. And you say, again, why is that? Why does he do that here? Well, he says, things are violent around me. Things are unjust around me. You're allowing this destruction. And I know we're your people. Why are you letting all these things happen? Why are you letting things become such a huge mess? That's what he's so confused about. And God's reply in verses 5 through 11, we'll look at more in a moment, is basically, I'm raising up Babylon. I'm raising up the most ruthless, impetuous, and violent people around, and they're going to come and destroy and conquer your country. And so Habakkuk's reply, if we could paraphrase it, is, what? You call that an answer? He's like, are you kidding me? Really? I just complained about the evil in our nation, and you're telling me we're going to be crushed by a more evil nation? How is that possible? And Habakkuk comes close to saying, are you crazy? Can that be right? He comes close to saying that here. And you have to see he's almost sort of lost it. He's really pushing the envelope in his response to God here. And he's being very frank, almost to the point of offense. He's challenged by God, and he's making that challenge known to God. And that's one thing you see in the way Habakkuk is responding here. There's another thing on the other side that you see here in the way Habakkuk's responding. As the book goes on, Habakkuk says, I'm going to wait and see what God says to me. So after he prays in verses 2 through 4, and then God answers in verses 5 through 11, he prays again at the end of the chapter to God. And God's answer is in chapter 2 that you'll look at next week. And what you see there is that while Habakkuk initially raises this challenge to God, he's frank and he struggles with his doubt before God, he also never indicates, it never even seems to enter his mind here, that the solution would be just to sort of walk away from God or to sort of defect from God or to not obey God or to leave God in any sense. That's not an option for Habakkuk. Why is that? Well, look at what he says. Even though he says, God, I think you're contradicting yourself. In the same moment, he's actually praying to God about this. He's actually speaking to God, knowing who he is about this. And he says in the second clause there in verse 12, my God, my Holy One. And that's right after this sort of striking rhetorical question. He says, my God, my Holy One. And I was really helped here by the way the guy I mentioned earlier, Keller, explains this. He says, what he's doing here is he's wrestling faithfully with God. He's wrestling, but he's doing it faithfully with God. He has these two aspects together. Do you see that? Do you see how he's just really wrestling with, but he's also very faithful to God and trusting God as he's asking those questions. And you need to realize, I think, how rare of a thing that is, how uncommon of that sort of combination of things that is. It's so uncommon to have that kind of balance when we're working through our frustrations with God. I mean, people usually swing, you know, all the way one way or all the way the other way. Either they take the very traditional sort of religious route and say, this is God. Don't ask him any questions. And they're not really sort of honest with God about how frustrated they are. And they don't actually take their questions to him. They see him as a not so benevolent dictator, perhaps. And don't ask any questions. You know, don't actually say what you're struggling with. That's a common response from people that maybe are more traditionally religious on their side, or maybe really progressive and modern people who have such confidence in their own perception and their own reason that they say, well, look, what's happening? God just can't be at work here. There's no way God could be at work here, and he obviously doesn't care about what's going on here. Therefore, I'm not going to have anything to do with him. I mean, that's the kind of opposite response, isn't it? And if that's what God's about, then I'm not interested. That's sort of the opposite response. But notice Habakkuk, he avoids either of those extremes here. Can you see that? He's incredibly frank. He's incredibly honest with God, more so than the sort of traditional religiosity. But he's also incredibly committed to God. He's incredibly committed to God, more so than modern people usually are. He wouldn't think about leaving God, and he wants to know why in the world God's doing what he is. He says, my Holy One. And he seems to be saying, I wouldn't be so upset if you weren't holy, but you are. You know, I wouldn't be so despondent if I weren't so committed to you, but I am. I can't live without you, so help me live with you. And that seems to be the attitude that Habakkuk comes to God with. Where else would I go? You know, you have the words of eternal life, as the New Testament takes in that idea. I can't live without you, so help me live with you. And it's an incredibly rare sort of attitude here. And it's the attitude and the sort of comportment toward God that can only come by an experience of God's grace. It's the kind of attitude that can only come by an experience of God's grace to produce this sort of faithful wrestling. You might ask, kind of in this passage, you know, why do we have the prayer of Habakkuk here for us to read centuries later? You know, are we supposed to model this sort of prayer? Are we supposed to pray like this ourselves? It's a good question. And commentators are divided on how to sort of think about this kind of a thing. I would say not exactly. Not exactly. And there is a really helpful commentator I read on this, Derek Kidner, Old Testament commentator, who had something really helpful to say about this prayer and what's going on here. He said, you know, God preserves these prayers of Habakkuk here, not exactly as a model, but to show us that God knows how we speak when we're desperate. You know, God knows how we speak to him when we're desperate. And God is showing that he remained Habakkuk's God through this. Not because Habakkuk just sort of put on a happy face, not because Habakkuk had emotional self-control, because he didn't, but to remind Habakkuk of God's grace, because God says, I am their God, and they are my people. And it's because of God's unconditional love, his covenantal love, and Habakkuk knows that love, and Habakkuk appeals to that love throughout the book here. Even the rhetorical question in verse 12 that we looked at starts with the word, Lord, which in Hebrew is Yahweh, God's covenantal name. He addresses him with that covenantal name. And the reason I think Habakkuk has the freedom to honestly ask God about these genuine questions he has is because he knows something of the grace of God. He knows the relationship he's in with God. And that makes you a faithful wrestler. You can wrestle faithfully with God. You know you can ask. You know that your salvation is not based on doing everything right. You know the grace of God. This is the kind of relationship you see Habakkuk has with God. And I think how these questions come out of, the sort of attitude these questions come out of. That's what Habakkuk's doing. That's what he's become by God's grace. He saw evil days. He faced these evil days. So what does he hear from God? What does he hear from God in verses 5 through 11? Well, this is the first answer. You have, you know, a series of these answers in the book of Habakkuk. This is the first answer God gives. And it comes through in verses 5 through 11. God says, I'm going to tell you something that you won't believe and that you won't understand. Do you see that in verse 5? He says, look at the nations and watch. Be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. And then in verse 6, he says, I'm raising up the Babylonians, the ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth, to seize dwellings not their own. So when Habakkuk says, why all the injustice? Why all the violence at the beginning of the book? Where is your salvation, God? Replies to him, I'm going to bring more injustice and more violence to you. And that's how I'm going to work out my salvation. And you're not going to understand it. And I think this, at least one thing we learned from this is God is saying, don't try to judge me on the basis of what you observe in the world. Don't try to judge me and to discern who I am and what I'm doing solely on your perception of what's happening in the world, based off your understanding of history, based off your timetable. To Habakkuk, who says, I don't understand, you're supposed to bring salvation to the world through Israel, and Israel's rotting from the core, you've got to do something, God replies, I am doing something. I'm raising up evil Babylon, and they're going to conquer your nation and take you into exile. And Habakkuk says, you call that an answer? And God says, yeah, that's an answer. And do you realize here, there are all sorts of things, of course, that Habakkuk couldn't see, aren't there? There are all sorts of things that Habakkuk couldn't see. Here's one possibility of something he couldn't see. If the Jews hadn't been conquered back here in the Old Testament, if they hadn't been conquered and Judah hadn't been scattered across the empire, then they wouldn't have been scattered into all sorts of cities, and there wouldn't have been synagogues in all sorts of cities that there ended up being synagogues in. And if there hadn't been synagogues in all these cities, there wouldn't have been so many people exposed to the God of Israel in the way they were. And then we get to the New Testament. There's all sorts of people floating around that you read about, like in the book of Acts, these God-fearers, these Gentiles who were pagans, who got attached to a synagogue somewhere in a city. And then the gospel comes to them. And when Christianity spread in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, you'll notice these God-fearers, these Gentiles who were attached to the synagogue, they were some of the most responsive people to the Christian message, right? And that's just one of the sort of things that, you know, might have never happened if God hadn't acted and worked in this sort of way. Or how about a modern example of us looking at the work of God? Very likely you've heard about and thought about what happened when the Communist Party came in and took over China, right? There are all sorts of mission efforts going on then. And when that happened, overnight, all the Western missionaries could get kicked out of the country. And Western people like us tend to think, oh, this is it. You know, that, you know, over 100 years of work, you know, is lost here. That church can't make it without us. And people said, you know, why did God let this happen? Why did something so terrible happen there? And so the Habakkuks of that day said, why did God abandon China? You know, where is God, you know, when China needs him? But of course, anybody that knows a little bit about the history of China and mission in China, what happened there? Well, once all those Western missionaries left, the church became much more indigenous, both in its population and in its leadership, right? Became much more indigenous, became much more vibrant and much more vital, and now is one of the fastest growing churches in the world. Many Christians in China and a healthy growing church in a situation we might have never thought, and many people never thought would be good. Do you see that? And you see how it's quite difficult to look at a situation and say, well, clearly God is or isn't doing this, or clearly this is a bad thing that God must have removed his good hand from. It's quite difficult to make those kinds of judgments. And so when God says to Habakkuk, okay, Habakkuk, you want to know what I'm doing? I'll tell you, but you won't get it. And Habakkuk says, yeah, tell me what you're doing. And God says, okay, I'll tell you, but you're not going to understand. And he says, I don't get it. And God says, I told you you wouldn't get it. It's sort of like I have a 4-year-old and a five-year-old, almost 6-year-old. And if my 4-year-old comes to me and says, hey, I want to eat this Easter bunny, this chocolate Easter bunny for dinner because it looks really good. And I say, well, yeah, it's too much sugar in that, and it's too much chocolate, you know, in that, and it's quite too unhealthy to have for your dinner. You can have a little bit of it. And my 4-year-old kind of whines at me, and I say, look, let me explain this to you. You can't have this. And then I proceed to kind of go through the finer points of nutrition and explain why this is a bad idea. And my 4-year-old continues to whine, I'm sure, at this point. And I say, you've got to trust me. This is not a good idea. Tummy's going to hurt. It's going to be bad. And after 5 minutes of this, I say, okay, enough. It's done. That's it. End of conversation. Now, why is it that the average modern person says, well, I don't understand what God's doing, but I can't trust him? But the distance between our mind and God's mind is infinitely greater than the distance between my mind and my 4-year-old's mind. Right? God's ways are above our ways, we're told. God's ways are different than our ways. And we don't always know exactly how he's working. And much of what he does doesn't make sense to us. And that's one of the basic things you see in the book of Habakkuk here. And we learn from him that you trust God, even in light, and especially in light, of difficult circumstances. You trust God. You faithfully wrestle with him, especially through those circumstances. And that's what Habakkuk saw. He saw evil days. That's what Habakkuk did. He faced those evil days. And that's what he heard, to trust God. And God called him to trust him. I'm doing something you're not going to understand. Trust me here. But we might ask lastly here, but before we think about a couple questions tonight, we might ask, what does it mean here when God says, I'm doing something in your day that you wouldn't believe? You know, I'm doing something there in the nations that you wouldn't believe. I'm going to bring salvation out of judgment. I'm going to bring salvation and violence and oppression out of violence and oppression and injustice. I know you're not going to understand, but that's what I'm doing. What does he mean when he says that? But it's actually really fascinating. This little section of Habakkuk gets picked up by Paul in Acts chapter 13, verse 41. He actually picks up this sort of amazing statement that God says here. And what happens is Paul, there in Acts 13, verse 41, he's preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's in a synagogue preaching the gospel. He's explaining how God has worked all through the history of Israel, as he does in many of his sermons there in Acts. He traces that through, and he shows how that happens all the way up into the life and death of Jesus Christ. And then he proclaims at the end that God has raised Jesus Christ from the dead. And then he says, take heed and remember what the prophets say. And he quotes Habakkuk 1:5. Look, I'm going to do something in your days that you'd never believe, even if someone told you. And Paul says, when God said, I'm going to do something that you'd never believe, I'm going to bring salvation out of judgment, I'm going to bring salvation out of violence and injustice, Paul says, he's actually talking about Jesus Christ. And you say, wait a second. No, he's talking about the Babylonians. Well, of course you're right. Actually, Paul is also right. And Paul is showing us that when God says, I'll bring light out of darkness, when God says, I'll bring salvation out of injustice and out of violence, when he says, divine salvation that comes from God is ultimately going to be fulfilled in Jesus Christ our Lord. That's what he's pointing to here. Do you know that? Do you see that? Do you see what he's trying to show us? Because when Jesus Christ came into the world, he went to the cross and he took the judgment we deserve. And he experienced violence. And he was tried by a kangaroo court. And he didn't receive justice. He received injustice. And he suffered. And he died. All these things that Habakkuk was complaining about. And when Habakkuk says, you know, I don't understand, how can you have injustice? How can all these terrible things happen? How can you use the wicked to judge on the cross? You actually see the ultimate example, the ultimate picture, the fulfillment of that. On the cross, a bit of that's explained. That's explained because on the cross, God became the just and the justifier, as we read in Romans 3:26. On the cross, justice was fully and finally met when the Son of God took our judgment, when the Son of God took our penalty. And he was the true light shining in the darkness. He was the true redemption out of evil circumstances. He was the true salvation out of injustice. And the people standing there in front of the cross, the people standing there said, we don't understand. How could this possibly be something that God is doing? How could he bring good out of this? And yet, on the third day, all of those previous false perceptions were shattered at the resurrection of the Son of God and his victory over all the forces of injustice and in darkness and of death itself. And for now, for those of us who are joined to him by faith, you can look at suffering with a completely different perspective because of Jesus Christ. You can look at your evil days, right, in your life, and you can say, well, I don't understand what God would possibly do with this, but I know what he has done in Jesus Christ. Do you see that? Do you see that through the cross and the resurrection, they actually have the ultimate Habakkuk? Habakkuk is perplexed in this book. He's confused and he's upset. He wrestles with God. He says, God, where are you? But he's faithful through that. And Jesus Christ is the ultimate Habakkuk because there he is in the garden. And he says, Father, if it's possible for this cup to pass from me, let it pass from me. He's wrestling so deeply with this. He says, is there any way out of this? Is there any way this cup can pass from me? And then he says, but not my will, but your will be done. You see what he's doing? He's faithfully wrestling for us. Jesus Christ is faithfully wrestling for us, for you. And Habakkuk, he didn't know the level of despair that Jesus Christ went through. Jesus Christ unjustly received what we justly deserve. And if you know that Jesus Christ bore the weight, that he was faithful and that he persevered for you, when evil times came upon him, then you know you can persevere in him when evil times come upon you. And you can see Jesus Christ saying to you, when you look at my death and resurrection, when you see dark times can come upon you, it doesn't mean God has abandoned you. Dark times happen to people that don't deserve it. That's what happened to me. But know everything that God is doing, God does for a reason. And more than that, know that everything that bad has happened has been resolved, in a sense, in Jesus Christ, and will ultimately be resolved at his return. And when that happens, we can see more clearly than we can today. We'll see much more clearly is the way the Bible talks about it. And until then, he calls us to trust him, to look to him, and to believe in him these days. Yeah, I'll stop there. So why don't you guys take a few minutes, ask some questions, kind of wrestling with some of those questions that Habakkuk has. Take a few minutes, maybe groups of four or five, chat about those, maybe for 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, however long it takes. I think we've got plenty of time. And then close time in prayer, and we'll wrap it up that way.